Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation.
You are a human animal. You are a very special breed. For you are the only animal who can think, who can reason, who can read.
Hello and welcome to Bookworm. This is Michael Silverblatt, and my guest is Toni Morrison. She is, of course, the author of Beloved and the author, more recently, of Jazz and Paradise. She began publishing with The Bluest Eye, followed by Sula, The Song of Solomon, Tar Baby, and she really is one of my most admired American writers. I wrote her a letter 2 weeks ago, knowing that the movie of Beloved would be coming out, and wanting, not even having seen the film, to talk about the book, because it's my sense that after a movie hits the public, a book is altered by it, and that there are things that we find in language, in the shaping and writing of literature, that a movie cannot touch, not because it doesn't want to or because it's inadequate, but because they're different art forms, because it can't. Now, it seems to me that at the center of Beloved is not the thing that people always talk about. They always talk about a story that happened in the days of slavery, in which an actual woman killed her children rather than seeing them brought back and living the life that she had led on the plantation. But it seems to me that while this is the background of the book, what the writer has done is bring to it the question, which becomes the question in your following two books, Jazz and Paradise: what will you do? What kind of love is too much? And when does love of another eclipse the love of the self?
The question is, how are we able to love under duress? And when we can, what distorts it for us? And how can we negotiate the various kinds of claims and loves that we choose in order to make it include ourselves, the love of the self that is not narcissistic, not simply selfish, and also to love something bigger than ourselves that is not martyrdom, not setting oneself aside completely. You know, negotiating between those two extremes to get to some place where the love is generous.
Yes, now it seems to me that in the same way that one finds oneself afterward on a path without knowing when one's embarked, that the books, all of them, lead up to this. The first book, The Bluest Eye, is about the consequences of self-loathing. Mm-hmm. And the books that follow take the impaired self into the world where attempts at love are made. And in a sense, it's not until Beloved that the question of a transfiguring love, one that might destroy the self in the process of being enacted, becomes the central subject of the book. So in a way, all of the books have been a sequential path from the frightened self to the self that begins to risk in the world, and then the self that is taking grand and possibly disastrous strides.
True. Yes, because the frailty of the first book, of that child who is fairly doomed by things outside of her control and collapsing, really, emotionally, all the way to another kind of child, I suppose, in Beloved, hunger for disrupted love, lack of love, abandoned love, matching with the ferocity of mother love, which is on the one hand laudatory and on the other something that can actually condemn everybody, not just her child, but herself and her living child, and make love impossible for her with a man. You know, all consuming mm-hmm. love, which is an exaggeration, of course, of parental love, but loving in an exaggerated, fierce, unhealthy, distorted way, under circumstances that made such a love logical. I mean, you know, she's not merely psychotic. You know, she just didn't erupt into the world that way. I mean, Setha. But trying very hard as a writer to put into language the theatricality and the meaning of these kinds of distortions in order to reveal not only their consequences, but what one should be warned against, what we should look out for, what we should be wary of. And I thought, beloved, circumstances, the book, circumstances were not limited in any way to 1873 or 1855. I think for those of us who live in 1998, male or female, the problems of trying to love oneself and another human being at the same time is a serious late 20th century problem, a very serious problem. And I thought in particular, mother love is a very serious problem in late 20th century because of the choices that women can make now. You don't really have to have children. And some women feel that not having children is the freedom they seek. And some women feel that having children is the fulfillment they seek. But in both cases, you know, things can go completely and terribly wrong. If you don't understand, and no one does instantly, what that means. So I thought that it was interesting to me to write in 1984, I guess I started, about how one woman felt that she was only free and complete when she asserted herself as a mother, as opposed to post-feminist notions of not having to be forced into motherhood as a way of completing, fulfilling the self and expressing one's freedom. So that it's not so much that they're contrary, it's just the same area, the same park in which I wanted to work and work out the problems of that kind of love as opposed to, say, the notions of romantic love in the so-called jazz age compared to our notions of romantic love these days. I think I'm trying to stress the point that I guess I'm echoing something you said earlier, which is whatever the historical background, my hope, my earnest hope, was that the relevance of these people, whatever race, whatever region, whatever the historical circumstances were, resonate powerfully with contemporary difficulties.
In In these books, which years ago you mentioned you brought the manuscript of Beloved to your editor, Robert Gottlieb, feeling that it was not complete, that it was one part of a trilogy of novels, and you didn't even know if it could be published on its own.
No, that's true.
In each of these books, though, a triangle or a configuration emerges, and it's as if the brilliance of the book is to rotate that configuration, which I see as a triangle, mm-hmm. from every conceivable angle. In jazz, because the metaphor is jazz, the characters at the vertices of these figures, they do their solos, they speak, mm-hmm. they have arias. In Beloved too, one senses that the whole novel has been directing itself toward a moment that in my mind a film can't possibly realize, a moment of locked gaze and psychic transfer that seems at the heart of the narration of all of these books, that there be a moment when there is an exchange of eye and feeling, mind and touch, that allows people to know each other's stories without speaking them.
Mm. Well, you have a major void in a movie, which is you don't have a reader, you have a viewer. And that is such a different experience. As subtle as a movie can be, as careful and artful as it can be, in the final analysis, it's blatant, you know, because you see it and you can translate certain things, make certain interpretations and wonder, and certainly there can be mystery. But the encounter with language is such a private exploration. The imagination works differently. The things that I can create and hint at via the structure, via the choice of words, via the silences, are not the kinds of things that would be successful in any movie. And when it becomes, you know, sort of pointed and successful that way, it loses something. So for me, what you call the exchange of mind and self-touch, none of that they would even attempt, because that's not what movies do or do well. And I had to realize, although I was not very interested in selling any book to the movies ever, and when I was persuaded to complete the sale of this one, I thought I would let them do what they do and I would go home and do what I do. And I had no further contact with it until, indeed, they were filming. And I went there to say certain things that I thought might be helpful and might be used, but probably would never be. But I felt it important to simply say these things. And my judgments were powerfully structural. You know, where to linger, where not to. And they were really unusable. They were literally unusable by anybody because they were not cinematic.
I want to let listeners know that I'm talking to Toni Morrison, and I want to explain the context here. I think that trust and the agreement between a writer and a reader is very important to her. And so when I wrote a letter to her several weeks ago, it was not only that we would talk, but we would talk from her home, because that was a decision not to be going out on the road again to be making pronouncements or flacking for the movie, that the movie is a separate thing. And so we're talking from studio to Toni Morrison's home, and the sounds that you hear are the sounds of intimacy, not of an accidental bad connection. It was out of respect for the writer that led to this particular circumstance. It seems to me that your fiction does bring the reader to a space that cannot be defined, that must be, for lack of better terms, called the sacred or indeterminate space of the imaginative experience.
Exactly.
That words are the inadequate clothing of that experience when you're reaching the heart. Up until that point, the writer's choices, word by word, are immensely important. When you reach the heart, no word can be correct. Mm-hmm. You're talking about an experience that is close to a mystical experience.
Wow, I wanted precisely that point to be rendered in a couple of occasions in Beloved, but particularly when the women are in front of Seth's house, having been persuaded that enough is enough. And when they go there, they come with what they've got, whatever faith they've got, whatever superstition they've got, whatever religious iconography they have, using all the, you know, symbolic world. And then they pray and they do things. And then there's a moment when that, none of that, not the symbol they hold in their hands, not the cross they may have around their necks, not the desire to have their will done. The only thing that works is to go very, very far back before language, when there was only the sound. The sound is a kind of choral singing in this case, which works, I think, in terms of the folklore, in terms of who those people were. But it's another way of saying, of their saying and my saying, I can't say what this is. There are no words to tell you mm-hmm. how to get there from here.
Now, as opposed to that that can't be voiced, there is another kind of silencing that runs through the work that is not helpful to a writer, that a writer fights with every straining instinct against. That is the silence that fills the master's wife's throat. She can no longer speak. It is the silencer on the gun that kills Dorcas. She is silenced in Jazz. And I wondered if you could talk about the ways in which these books combat silence.
Well, that's an interesting way to put it. I think the signal instrument of silence for me in Beloved was the bit, which mm-hmm. was a kind of familiar and frequently used homemade instrument that you put into a person's mouth, which you could adjust. And there are quite a variety of them. And whatever other feature they had, they were not to keep you from working, because you worked with them, but they were to shut you up so that you could not say, you could not talk back, you could not articulate a contrary position or do any violence with your tongue or your words. And that was a complete erasure of all language that the victim or the oppressed had. So for me, it was operating this way. I would try to say what they were prevented from saying.
Mm-hmm. It seems to me that the writer's role in work of this kind is to save the characters from the silencing of society mm-hmm. and bring them to that point that can only be quasi-articulate of the witnessing of the holy or the miraculous.
Precisely. Indeed it is. It's bearing witness on the one hand. It's, in a way, you mentioned it yourself, it's not quite secular. Let's put it that way. It's not quite secular work.
Yes. Now, in that scene of the bit, there is what I consider to be one of the signatures and triumphs of your way of looking and writing. In the scene in which this brutal silencing occurs, several tortures and punishments are going on at once, several witnessings without voicings. What we see instead is that rooster, and I wondered if you would tell me about him.
Oh, yeah, it was, you know, imagining it myself, you know, the sort of what must it feel like, what must it look like, this man under those circumstances being treated like a beast. So you're trying to not just, you know, reemphasize that, but to have him look at something that is edible, something that he brought into the world.
Mm-hmm.
But nevertheless, you know, roosters have a kind of royal way of behaving and sometimes in the yard. And to have him compare himself to a creature so beneath him, but who visually, if you imagine, visualize a rooster, you see the crown, you see the beak, you see the eye, you see something close to an eagle, so you see something painterly that you recognize as having at least a certain kind of a visual authority. The rooster crows, etc. But you know really that it's just a little, you know, 3 or 4 pounds of nothing. And to have him feel less than that, and more importantly, to know that rooster.
Mm-hmm.
He has a name. He remembers when it was born.
Yes,
he remembers helping it. And they named it Mister because he was so tough. So here we have a man who will never be called Mister, walking out of that yard, looking at a rooster that is already called Mister.
And also participating in a kind of, in flashback, in a kind of ritual.
Yes.
Of male birth.
Mm-hmm.
That he has in
is
some way mothered this rooster. Yeah.
Totally.
So amazing. Now this, of course, is what a movie cannot do, because it can only show you a rooster. It can't tell you where the rooster came from. It can't make the red of its comb pulsate the way yours does. It cannot enter the mind of the man who named it Mister, whose mouth is filled by a bit. These are those things that in a book last beyond the book. They're intersections that the author has structured that editing in movies can only rarely, you know, one needs an Eisenstein to think of a structure that would allow for so much association, so much fullness.
Mm-hmm.
To go on in the midst of such devastation.
They're so different. I, you know, it's a most obvious thing to say, but I had no idea how very different the whole experience is, what you're being driven to. And I don't have any it's not even a reduction, it's just a powerful difference. When I, first of all, it was important to me, at least on the paperback jacket, not to see Beloved's face.
Mm-hmm.
That she must be someone that the reader invents. Well, already when you're in the movie situation, you have a face that fixes it. So it moves from there to other kinds of scenes, gestures, voices, some of which enhance, I have to tell you, what the dialogue might be. You hear other things with very good actors, and they're very good in this movie. On the other hand, they're just whole areas that not only are not there, they're not gestured toward, but the mechanics of cinema doesn't work toward that anyway. You know, the part that you work so hard for is of no use whatsoever. They cannot use it and should not. I remember a scene in Paradise in which I worked a long time with a couple of scenes to make sure that the palette was right, that the same colors that were in this scene were also in another scene. And I don't expect a reader to necessarily know all of that, but I do believe that because I painted the scene the same colors, there's this sort of undertow or urtext where it may not look comparable in terms of the two scenes, but the reader may not even know that they're getting the nature of the comparison because I have painted them that way.
Well, it's very deeply embedded in the work, and what I find myself saying about that, it's kind of wonderful. It came to me in Beloved with Baby Suggs's quilt, in which there are two patches of orange, and Baby Suggs is working on pink, that what is going on in this book is that we are thinking about color in new ways.
In a fresh way.
Yes.
I wanted it to be absolutely raw, and the rest of the book is sort of, nobody mentions color. And then when Setha meets Paul D again, and she thinks about maybe this can work, she thinks about color. Maybe she'll look at turnips. Maybe she'll look, you know, it's a pleasure. It's a deep, sensual, gratifying pleasure.
And not only that, it's a way of making new, you know, what is a black writer supposed to do? He or she is supposed to think about color. And here it is. You've got it. I'm doing it right now.
You got it.
I've been speaking to Toni Morrison, the author of Beloved. It is a conversation occurring on the occasion of the film, but not about the film. It's the attempt to celebrate the depths of a book that a film can't touch. Thank you very much for joining me, Toni.
This has been a pleasure.
I would like to thank Pamela Hemstell, Toni Morrison's assistants, the people at KCRW who made this hookup possible. My associate producer is Melinda Siegel. The engineer is Jennifer Swadek. Special production assistance today from Alan Howard and development by Beverly Walker. I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next week on Bookworm.
To the jungles you can go in books.
Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation. This program is made available to the public radio system by SAS, a satellite service of KCRW Santa Monica. Cassette copies of this and other Bookworm programs are available. For ordering information, call KCRW at 310-450-5183.
Make you laugh and say, books tell you everything. They're your treasure, friends in prose and rhyme.
Now with Book of the Mouse, what time?
I want to tell you about a new show from the Financial Times called Life and Art from FT Weekend, hosted by me, Lila Reptopoulos. Life and Art is twice a week. On Mondays, I have a guest on to talk about life and how to live a good one. Everything from winter travel to cooking to living more creatively. And on Fridays, we talk art. Two FT journalists and I discuss a piece of culture that's in the air, new music, movies, and more. Find Life and Art from FT Weekend wherever you listen.